From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop, and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, July 19th through Friday, July 23rd, 2021. It was a week of breakthroughs and setbacks, partisan bickering, a troubled Olympics, meteorological disasters, vaccine hesitancy, election denial, inflation indication, topics in the tropics, rising crime, gun violence, and another billionaire in space. Kind of an average week on 21st century Earth. Stand by, as we're about to embark upon a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio. We'll also be playing a fascinating excerpt from the blockbuster 12-part podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. Its host, James Golden, interviews me about my relationship and memories of the late talk radio legend. Speaking of microphones, we'll hear from opinionated people with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation. In a deafeningly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard on great radio stations across the U.S. and in the U.K. An examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the billionaire space race. This week, it was Amazon mogul Jeff Bezos' turn to take a short ride into space, following the accomplishment a week or so earlier by fellow billionaire Richard Branson, a feat many observers call a major step forward in the exploration of space by the private sector.
Meantime, others have been quite critical of the flight, calling it a joyride and describing the prospect of space tourism as a waste of money and self-serving excess on the part of the super rich.
At number 9 this week, the Tokyo Olympics. The International Games are off and running, beset by politics, scandals, and COVID-era restrictions.
Some folks out there on the talk shows of America question the validity and pertinence of the Olympics altogether as a viable international institution at this point.
At number 8 this week, the southern border crisis and immigration reform. Little has changed from last week regarding this hot spot and hot topic.
And yet, the only medium giving it the across-the-board coverage it warrants at this point is News Talk Radio.
At number 7 this week, U.S.-China relations tied with events happening in Haiti and Cuba. Things with China keep growing increasingly tense, from cyber spying to military expansionism to limited disclosure about the origins and spread of COVID-19.
So what do we do about China? Perhaps educating the American public and business community that being intrinsically involved with the communists in Beijing presents an existential threat to our economy and freedom, for starters. Meantime, political turmoil in both Haiti and Cuba have put our Caribbean island neighbors on the talk media menu of hot topics in the tropics.
At number 6 this week, crime and gun violence. The measurable spike in crime and shootings in America, particularly in the nation's urban centers, has become one of the hottest political topics across the nation, promising to have a strong impact on the coming round of municipal and statewide elections.
And of course, gun control becomes a hot topic in the midst of all this, as well as the ongoing issue of police reform.
At number 5 this week, the economy, tied with the nation's infrastructure and inflation fears. Wall Street suffered a steep drop during this past week of instability in the stock market amidst investor worries over the Delta variant threatening a return to lockdowns.
And a continuing rise in the cost of housing, food, and fuel are giving economists and consumers alike sleepless nights over worries about the possibility of uncontrollable inflation.
At number 4, the heat wave, wildfires, floods, and climate change. The weather's become more than just small talk, as lives are being lost due to erratic patterns in Mother Nature's behavior, not only in the U.S. but around the world. Last week, there were killer floods in Germany and its Western European neighbors. This week, there were similar disasters in China due to excessive amounts of rainfall. Subway systems have been particularly vulnerable to flooding, and have become horrific death traps in Chinese urban centers.
We had our own scary weather incident here in New England this week, as the electrical system at Talker's headquarters, including its radio studios, were fried by a nearby lightning strike during a massive thunderstorm. We're producing this installment of the show on backup and makeshift equipment, so please forgive its inconsistent quality. Hopefully, we'll be back up and running with full capabilities next week.
At number three this week, a three-way tie between election denial, voter legislation, and critical race theory. Former President Trump continues to make media appearances, repeating his claim, described by detractors as the big lie, that the 2020 election was beset by fraud and stolen from him, sparking voting reform legislation that opponents consider racist in Republican-dominated statehouses in red states across the nation.
Race relations continues to be a key issue of the times in America, with the latest issue of contention being the teaching of critical race theory in the public schools.
At number two, a three-way tie between the January 6th committee, Donald Trump's relationship with the GOP, and Trump books. Nancy Pelosi rejected adding Trump-supporting Republican legislators to the congressional committee being formed to investigate the Capitol riot of January 6th, sparking a GOP backlash and boycott of the process.
The former president's relationship with and influence within the Republican Party remains strong and continues to shape politics in America, although the pending indictments facing his organization and perhaps him personally, not to mention the slew of highly uncomplimentary books coming out about his last months in the White House, add to the uncertainty of his future.
At number one this week, COVID-19, the Delta variant, and vaccine denial. The coronavirus won't go away, neither as a pandemic nor as a talk media hot topic, with the highly contagious Delta variant spiking new cases across the nation, primarily among the unvaccinated.
Yet vaccine denial remains a significant politically motivated syndrome in the United States and a problem for conservatives who find themselves with mixed feelings, attitudes, and changing opinions on the subject, as indicated by Sean Hannity telling his viewers on the Fox News Channel to take the virus and vaccination options seriously, and Newsmax CEO Christopher Ruddy writing an editorial this week praising President Biden for his achievements in rolling out the vaccines to a growing segment of the American public. Thank you, Kevin Casey of Talkers Magazine.
You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. COVID-19 is all over the news and has maintained, if not increased, its grip on the top spot of the Talkers research as the most talked about topic on radio, TV, online, and satellite-delivered news talk shows across America. Joining us now is our medical correspondent, a widely respected physician heard daily on radio stations across the nation on the Genesis Communications Network, and one of this program's most dependable go-to sources for solid coronavirus information, Dr. Dahlia Wax.
Dr. Wax, the coronavirus is at the top of the news, and it's bad news. We have the Delta variant. We have the politics setting in again. We have September coming soon in schools, and it affects the young. What's your take on the whole situation?
It's obviously an emotional topic. We've been going through an emotional roller coaster where a couple weeks ago, people are shedding the masks. They're planning vacations. They're planning weddings. I'm starting to get all these invites to events. Fundraisers are now starting up again. And sadly, the Delta variant, as predicted, started to take hold. And it's been predicted to probably peak end of summer, early fall, just as kids are going back to school. And so this could really put a monkey wrench into everybody's plans in terms of being able to move forward and get on with our lives. Now, the Delta variant wouldn't have that control if it wasn't so contagious. And sadly, we're seeing that it can kill kids, with the Georgia boy who was only 5 years old with no previous medical history dying of the Delta variant, causing pneumonia and stroke. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussions coming as to, you know, how many vaccinated individuals are ending up in the hospital versus unvaccinated. Have masks and social distancing done anything? Is this virus outsmarting those methods, or are they effective enough barriers? And so, unfortunately, we're having similar conversations that we had 15 months ago, and it seems like same poop, different day, but it is a different beast, this variant. And so that's why we can't use last year's knowledge on so much on this particular strain.
How different are these variants from each other? Are they still COVID-19, or are they really just different species or genres, if you will, of coronavirus?
A variant is just a difference in the genetic makeup of something that could be very similar at its base. So the coronavirus family, they're very similarly shaped, but then differences can arise in their spike proteins. And the spike proteins are significant in that they are what latches onto the human cell and aids its infectivity. So when there are spike protein variations genetically, it could lead to strains that could be weakened or that could be stronger. And so sadly, these variants like the alpha variant, the lambda that was isolated in Peru and that now has been showing up in America, and then the delta variant, which is assuming close to 90% of the current cases, these things have changes in their spike protein from the original wild type strain, which hit America allegedly late 2019, early 2020. So these things, it could be a different beast if the variations are so much that it won't succumb to our vaccine regimen or our monoclonal antibody regimen. But if they are able to, acquiesce to our immunity through the vaccines, then they're not as much of a different beast.
Look, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how long do you think it's going to be before we'll be able to vaccinate small children?
They believe, great question, they believe that they will have some of the data and enough to emergency authorize a pediatric vaccine by late fall. In terms of, though, convincing parents of getting it, most parents are going to want to wait for full approval. So even though we might have a pediatric vaccine, I think there's going to be a lot of hesitancy from parents until it's fully approved. So even if we do get it in the fall, I don't see mass enthusiasm until full approval comes in.
When you say hesitancy by parents, you mean some parents? Because I hear a number of parents out there saying they can't wait to be able to vaccinate their children.
Well, yes, there was about a 5-hour meeting with the Clark County commissioners here in Nevada, and they asked the chief medical officer to talk about which groups are the highest of unvaccinated. And he said the biggest groups that are unvaccinated are those under 18 and those who are African American. And so efforts to try to, and a lot of the kids aren't making the decisions, it's the parents. I do know some parents who said, sign me up. But in my neck of the woods, we have the means to vaccinate 12 on up, and people are not bringing their kids in. We have a very low vaccination rates in that population. So even though parents might be excited, they might not be able to get their kid to go in. So it's interesting to hear those statistics coming from health experts saying our biggest struggles are going to be the African American community and those under 18.
Now, you're in Las Vegas, one of the really hot spots in terms of both COVID and climate. So what's it like there?
So it's hot. And in Nevada, we don't really have a beach to go to, which is why Hawaii has been urging their residents to be cautious if they come to Vegas, because people don't, from Hawaii, they don't necessarily come to the United States to go to the beach. They have beaches. They go to the most exciting play place there is, in our country, in the world. And so with Vegas, we are really concerned about the safety not only of our residents but of our tourists. But a big concern we have is Vegas was so hit so hard that the reluctancy of people coming back to work, if you add on top of that people getting sick, they're going to shut down again. And so the commissioners have been kind of looking at all aspects of this. They want tourists to come and have fun, and they stop short of asking them to wear the vaccines, but currently all employees facing the public have now been moved to a mask mandate.
As a media professional, the News Talk Radio, what are your thoughts about conservative news outlets like Fox and Newsmax, people like Sean Hannity and Chris Ruddy, suddenly telling people to get vaccinated? Chris Ruddy even praised Joe Biden for how effective he's been in rolling out the vaccine.
I think it is fantastic that the news outlets are trying to show, guys, we're not the ones telling people not to get vaccinated, and whoever's accusing us of doing that needs to you know, start steering the conversation to what actually is happening.
That's our medical correspondent, Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network, reporting in from Las Vegas, Nevada. Coming up next, a visit with former Rush Limbaugh producer Bo Snerdly, a.k.a. James Golden. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the things we do on this program is not only provide an overview of what's being discussed on the various platforms of American talk media, but we occasionally take our listeners behind the scenes in the business of spoken word programming via the resources of Talkers Magazine. And that's exactly what we're going to do right now. I had the honor this week of being interviewed by the former producer of The Rush Limbaugh Show for a 12-part podcast series titled Rush Limbaugh, The Man Behind the Golden EIB Microphone. Known to the late talk radio giants listeners as Bo Snerdly, his actual name is James Golden. Golden also serves as host of the series, which he does tremendously well. The podcast pays tribute to Limbaugh and consists of stories and memories about the radio icon told by people who worked with him and knew him well. I appear as a guest on the 11th installment of the 12-part series just posted this past week. Through the special permission of Premier Networks, we're going to play the excerpt from the podcast in which I discuss my memories of Rush and share thoughts about the impact of his remarkable radio career.
First up, the founder of Talkers Magazine, Michael Harrison. Now, Michael, you've interviewed Rush Limbaugh. You interviewed him early on. But before we get to that, I'd like you to tell our audience how it came to be that you publish the leading magazine for the entire talk radio industry.
I had a background in trade publishing and in broadcasting. And I've always led a double life or a double career of being involved in the trades and also being involved in just about every end of being on air or managing, or I even owned a radio station. I've been a program director and I've been a personality, and I've been involved in music radio and in talk radio. In the trade arena, I was involved in the development of radio and records. I was its first managing editor when it started. And had also worked with Billboard magazine and published a couple of newsletters and tip sheets along the way. So, and I was doing talk radio on a rock station in LA for 11 years. And I always felt that when the 90s would come, this was during the 80s, that the 90s were going to be the decade of talk radio, that talk radio was going to become the dominant form of radio. So I wanted to do it professionally as a broadcaster, and I also wanted to be involved in it as a trade publisher. So when 1990 came around, I decided to take all the experience I had in both on-air
management, and trade publishing and put them into a trade publication that dealt with talk radio back in 1990 as if it were the talk radio industry. We called it the industry, even though it was just at that time basically a small portion of the radio industry. And fortunately, I was right. And that was 31 years ago. Talkers Magazine is still operating and still thriving, thank goodness, for which I'm very grateful. And it's extremely gratifying.
When did you first meet? When did you first become aware of Rush Limbaugh? How did that happen?
I heard him on the station that I had owned shortly after I sold the station. They put Rush Limbaugh on. I'm driving down Highway 91 in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I hear on my former station, the one that I owned, this is Rush Limbaugh. And, da, da, da. And I go, who the heck is that? It was like, it's like the first time I heard Elvis Presley. I remember that. I'm that old. And I remember the first time I heard the Beatles. I remember the first time I heard Rush Limbaugh on the air, and it just came through the speakers like a ton of bricks, that voice and that whole ownership of the airwaves, the ownership of the air. And that was the first time. And of course, being a student of the industry, I had not started Talkers yet. So I was in the process of thinking about it, obviously. I asked, who is this Rush Limbaugh? First of all, the name is funny, Rush Limbaugh, you know, and similar to Elvis Presley, when he first showed up on the scene, the name sounded very funny. People were making fun of it. They called him Elbow Parsley, you know, Rush Limbaugh. And, you know, you become used to a name after a while. And we're certainly used to the name Rush Limbaugh now. But that's how I first became aware of him. And it's very interesting the evolution that followed in terms of syndication during the midday was not something that major market radio was very quick to do. That was considered to be very daring to put a syndicated program on in the middle of the day.
And Rush talked about that, by the way. He was told at the time, this is never going to work. It's not going to work. Radio stations will not pick you up, et cetera. But he went ahead. And he and Ed McLaughlin. Did you know Ed McLaughlin?
I subsequently knew Ed. I did not know Ed personally. He was a major executive at ABC Radio. So being in the broadcasting business, I knew who he was, but I had not yet met him or interacted or done business with him. But I certainly knew who he was. And I knew that his starting a syndicated venture after leaving ABC was something to be taken seriously because he was what we call in the business a heavyweight. And obviously he was.
So Let's advance. You hear him. This is before you started Talkers Magazine.
Correct.
Follow your own evolution as a listener.
Well, I certainly understood the need to fill a void because that's what I call that positioning. And in radio, positioning is everything. And so it immediately struck me that his approach to talk radio from the conservative perspective, especially with humor. In many ways, he was sort of what on the right, what Jon Stewart was on the left. Heavy use of satire, heavy use of humor, heavy use of production and entertaining elements and parodies and wordplay and double entendres. So he was very entertaining and filled a void because talk radio was political. It was post-fairness doctrine, so you could be opinionated without being too restrained by fear that you'd be censored or censured by the government. And I knew right away, oh, this makes total sense. There's a giant market out there for conservative politics because, let's face it, most of the media was either moderate or liberal, and conservative politics was marginalized as radical, far right, very negative, pejorative. So I knew right away, this guy's got it all. He's positioned properly to fill the political void, politics being the major topic of interest on news talk radio, and he's entertaining, and he sounds good. His mechanics were that of a really seasoned top 40 jock. He knew the mechanics, and I'm very, very into mechanics because I just love radio. So I knew this was a guy to watch.
Explain what you mean, because we have a lot of people here that are not radio people. So when you say mechanics, okay, what are they talking? What is he talking about? What is mechanics?
Well, you know, people think you just get on the radio and you sit there and you spout your politics, or you spout what you want to do. But radio is a symphony. Radio is a combination. It's a continuum of elements. There's music and there's commercials and there are breaks and there's timing and we're working our way up to the clock. And at 1 o'clock, we've got the news and then we'll be back. And it's a whole dance of 30-second elements, 10-second elements, 60-second elements, bed music. There's a pacing to it. There's a sound and a texture to it that DJs who came out of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s inherently knew how to do. It's the reps. It's, if you want to be a pianist, you have to learn how to make your fingers work on the piano. If you want to be a baseball player, you have to do batting practice. You have to learn how to throw, how to catch, the basic mechanics of an entity. And radio's the same way. So, and you can hear it right away. Rush played the continuum of sound, the symphony of a sound of a radio station or a radio show, as one of its elements. He knew how to integrate his voice into that flow. I know it sounds esoteric and maybe I'm overanalyzing it.
No, you're not. Because this is one of the things that Rush talked about this on occasion. He would talk about it, but he wouldn't talk about it in depth the way that you are now explaining it. What he would say is that radio is theater, and you have to understand, just as an actor would, or someone in the theater business, you have to understand the theater. You have to understand, and there are no visuals. So what you have is the complete attention of someone who's listening. It is an active process to listen to somebody as opposed to look at something while you're busy doing something else.
Absolutely. And the theater is a perfect analogy. When you go into a theater, there's the curtain, there's the chandelier at the top of the roof if it's a classic old theater. There's the whole atmosphere of the theater, and then the lights go down. And then if it's a musical, the orchestra comes up, and then the curtain opens and the lights start. It's not just somebody standing on a stage talking to you. There's a whole environment, and the actor or the writer or each of the elements finds its place within this whole, you know, montage of synchronized entities. And Rush brought that to talk radio. So it was like listening to a music radio station where the station's format was part of the program. It was actually part of the show. The format was part of the show. He did that in talk before anybody else. And that is one of the things that made him successful. Obviously, he brought content and a lot of intelligence and other things to it. But that was the first thing I noticed, was his position politically, that he's filling a gap. And that's good for democracy, and that's good for radio, because people that feel left out, disenfranchised, hungry for that type of a point of view, empowered and franchised as opposed to disenfranchised, they would like that. But they're also radio listeners, and a radio listener knows when they're hearing the radio that it's not television. When you hear a television soundtrack on radio, it doesn't sound like a radio station. It sounds like there's something different about it. It has a hollowness to it. This was full radio, and that voice, it just was the right package at the right time. But I definitely think that his mechanics, back to that word, were one of the pillars upon which his success was built.
AM radio was in trouble at that time. People were wondering if AM radio would survive. Talk about that for a moment, please.
AM radio was in big trouble. And as I think Kris Kristofferson wrote in the Janis Joplin hit, Freedom's Just Another Word for Nothing Left to Lose, there was nothing left to lose. FM radio was eating AM radio's lunch with the music. It just didn't sound as good. So here's what happened. AM radio, first of all, radio fans, post-war baby boomers, knew how to use radio. They grew up with radio, and they knew what AM radio was. So they were not strangers to the dial. Talk sounded good on AM. The aforementioned fairness doctrine was repealed, which means now you can talk about politics and have opinion without having to hold back for fear that you're not giving every side proper exposure. And that's impossible to do because there are more sides to sides than anybody can believe. It's very subjective. So rather than be fair and have more points of view on the air, radio station said, we're not messing with this. They just never talked about anything controversial. That was gone. So controversial politics suddenly was fair game. The post-war baby boomers that grew up with pop radio and AM rock radio were getting older and suddenly interested in politics, suddenly interested in taxation, suddenly interested in various aspects of freedom, of government, of community, education, healthcare, public safety, foreign affairs. All of these things suddenly were of interest to basically the same audience that grew up listening to rock and roll. The demographic shift had happened. They were getting older. So suddenly the audience was there for that. And the thing that Rush did and that talk radio did was it provided the listeners with something that was important in their life. Something that was more than just background. It was heavy duty. It had teeth. It reflected the culture. And radio to succeed, going all the way back to the beginning, unlike other forms of media, had to be hip, grassroots, the sound of the street, the everyday person. And Rush accomplished that. And as a result, it kept AM radio alive. And I think to a certain extent, it kept all of radio alive.
You're listening to an excerpt from the 12-part podcast series titled Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, in which I was interviewed by James Golden. Coming up next, part two from the podcast, in which I discuss a personal encounter I had with Rush and more. In the meantime, before the break, let's take a quick look at the 10 most talked about people in News Talk Media this past week, the big newsmakers, according to the research of Talkers Magazine. Well, he went into space this week, and he made it to number 10, Jeff Bezos. At number 9, Tucker Carlson of Fox News Channel. Number 8, former Vice President Mike Pence. The governor of Florida, potential GOP presidential candidate. Number 7 is Ron DeSantis. Number 6, Mitch McConnell. Number 5, Kevin McCarthy. Number 4, Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker. Former President Donald Trump at number 3. The tag team of Dr. Tony Fauci and Rand Paul at number 2. And President Joe Biden came in at number 1. For information about what's happening in News Talk Media, check out talkers.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Some mistakes you just can't fix, like your retirement. You only get one chance, and with Grace Advisors, we'll help you make the most out of your one chance at a great retirement. At Grace Advisors, we make sure your retirement income is not at risk with the up and down ride of the stock market roller coaster. Instead, we build a foundation for your retirement, where when the market's up, you're up. When the market's down, you lose nothing, and we structure your plan in a way that you will save more on taxes, giving you an even greater return on your nest egg. So speak with the Grace Advisor, a Christian company, helping families protect their future every day. Call 888-585-1615. That's 888-585-1615. Call 888-585-1615 and speak to a Grace Advisor today. Or visit graceadvisors.com/radio.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. Let's jump back into the conversation I had with the late Rush Limbaugh's longtime producer James Golden for the just-posted 11th installment of the special 12-part podcast series Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone.
Back with Michael Harrison. Michael, when did you meet Rush?
I met Rush... I met Rush on the telephone in 1990 when I interviewed him for the second issue of Talkers Magazine. But I met him personally, I believe it was 1991, at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in San Francisco, in which he and I were on the same panel. And the panel had a couple of other people. I think Ron Owens from KGO in San Francisco was on it. And the conversation was, or included, is it possible for a national syndicated personality to appropriately put in midday on a major market radio station? That was the issue. It was that outrageous. And the audience was a little hostile to Rush and very positive about Ron Owens. And I believe the moderators were Ken and Daria Dolan. And I was on there as the Observer. Talkers was only 1 year old at the time, but fortunately we already were very popular. And I was the impartial observer. And that was where I met Rush Limbaugh.
You know, one of the things that I've thought for years is that so many broadcasters, and not just broadcasters, it's because, as you know, this is an industry that, to use a political phrase, trickles down into other areas. Mm-hmm. Jobs are not just created in a radio industry. You have the jobs that come from advertising. You have all the jobs that come from the advertising support. And it goes on and on. So Rush coming in and doing what he did for radio at such a critical time, one would think that there would be this swell of appreciation for it. Yet you mentioned there was a little bit of hostility. What did you attribute that to?
One, a lot of people in the business felt he was taking away jobs because, I don't know, maybe there were 100 stations, 50, 75, 200. It was far less than today during the original ascent of Rush Limbaugh and what I call the modern era of talk radio. So a lot of radio personalities felt he was taking away their jobs. There was the feeling that it was sacrilegious to have something that wasn't local on a radio station in the middle of the day. So there was hostility toward that. And I have to say that at that time, most of the ownership and most of the people in the radio business were of a moderate to liberal bent, and they found his politics offensive and disagreed with it. So the combination of what they perceived to be taking away jobs, which mathematically turned out not to be absolutely true, and we could talk about that if you want to, but there was hostility from an industrial standpoint in terms of the economics of it, the aesthetics of it, in terms of local versus national, and politically, there wasn't a fully developed conservative constituency within the radio business. And one of the interesting things, James, that happened in that encounter, because I was on the panel with him and we also had dinner together. I had dinner with Rush and the Dolans, and that was a very interesting dinner. But I had an encounter with him in the hallway. We're standing, it was just the two of us. And he looked at me and he said, "Michael, I have a question I want to ask you. Maybe you can give me an honest answer." I said, "Sure, Rush, what?" He said, "How come people don't like me?" It blew me away when he said, "How come people don't like me?" Like today in the panel, I just get the sense that people in this business don't like me. I think he then, you know, specifically pointed out as in this business. And I looked at him and I said, "Hey, they're jealous. Don't worry about it." Because I knew this guy was heading for stardom. I mean, it was just obvious to me. I've always been prescient about that type of thing. And I certainly was in that time. But I said, "Don't worry about it. They're jealous." But he was the thing that I learned in that moment was that he, even though he's tough and has teeth, as I said before, in terms of what he did on the air, personally, I got the impression that he's a very sensitive individual and was first coming around to understanding what it was like to be a public figure, even though the public in this case was in the industry, who meets with tremendous resistance and enemies. And I think it shook him up a little bit.
You know, that is really an interesting observation. And you mentioned before the jobs. I do want to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, he did take jobs from people that would be local on the stations that he was installed at. But conversely, he created more stations as a result of the success he brought to the format.
Right.
So he may have taken one job or two jobs from each station that existed when he first emerged on the scene. But as a result of Rush Limbaugh, hundreds of radio stations across America turned to the talk format, which created countless jobs from management to sales to on air to engineering. So I sat down and figured it out because it was a major issue. The guy's taking jobs. He's not taking jobs at all. He was making jobs in terms of the total sum of his impact.
Michael, here's the money question, as it were.
Uh-oh.
What is the legacy of Rush Limbaugh in the radio industry and beyond? Will there ever be anyone that does what Rush was able to do by way of accomplishment in this industry?
I certainly hope somebody comes along and gives a shot in the arm to this industry going forward that would be equal or greater than Rush, but I doubt that's going to happen. I do believe there will be other media, other platforms, other chapters of history, and other great movements. So, I'm a believer in the future, and I'm optimistic. But in terms of the time and space, the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century that Rush Limbaugh operated in, I think his legacy will be that he was certainly one of the greatest, I'm not talking about whether I agree with him politically, just one of the greatest broadcasters of the first 100 years of radio, and a major figure in keeping radio iconic and pertinent. And I believe also he will go down in history as being one of the most influential leaders of the modern conservative movement, the American conservative movement of the late 20th century and early 21st century. And that's a hell of a lot.
It really is. Let me give you my view for a moment on some of this. You know, when I first started with Rush, he was the first radio host I had ever heard that integrated email, this new thing that people were using. And back then he was using CompuServe. He used to give his CompuServe address out, invite listeners to be in contact with them, and in real time during the show would read some of those emails and respond to them, and integrated that in. Well, of course, today we have this direct messaging all over the place, instant messaging. And now it's text. Now it's instantaneous that you can get through. We have entire social media platforms built on interactivity. When Rush started and as the show became what it wasn't just radio. Television changed. What you mentioned about radio and the ownership was certainly true of television too. There was no conservative space on television for conservative politics. That has changed. The publishing world has changed, and that happened after Rush too. So my own view is that he is all of that and more in radio, but his impact on electronic and print media is sometimes not recognized. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, as you were saying it, I'm going, yeah, I missed that. That's definitely part of it. He definitely was a catalyst for our evolution during the aforementioned time, from the analog era to the digital era in terms of communications. And that, of course, goes way beyond any of the individual media platforms that we've cited. It really ties into a rapid jump ahead in terms of the wiring of the human nervous system. I mean, the way we're wired, the way we think, the way we are, ties into this analog to digital transition, which he did play a major role in catalyzing. So yeah, I agree with you fully.
Michael, this has been a real treat. You and I have known each other for quite a while, and you are just an incredible force in this industry. You know, it's amazing that your passion, and you were equipped. You were born to do what you're doing, apparently, because you had this dual interest in radio and in trade publications. and you were able to execute both of them flawlessly. And thanks to you, we have now an informed media. You are doing something unique, and you've done something unique in this industry. And you are just one of the giants. And so it is certainly our honor and pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much for saying that. I really appreciate it, James. And I wish you and everybody associated with that great chapter of broadcasting history the best going forward. Thank you.
The conversation you just heard is an excerpt in which I appeared as a guest on the 11th installment just posted this week of the 12-part podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. The host and interviewer of this series is Rush's longtime producer, James Golden, known to fans of The Limbaugh Show as Bo Snerdly. This broadcast was made possible by special permission of Premier Networks. If you'd like to listen to the entire podcast from which that interview was extracted, the name of the presentation is Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, and it's available at rushlimbaugh.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we have time for one more. The Olympics. Ah, the Olympics. Not off to the smoothest start, to say the least. Joining us now to discuss it is our Washington correspondent, the executive director of the D.C. radio company, Victoria Jones. So, Victoria, aside from the Norwegian women's beach handball team getting their panties in a bunch and getting fined 150 euros each to maintain their dignity, what's your take on the Olympics?
I think it is so boring, and it's even more boring when there's no audience. And anyway, I like the Winter Olympics because people jump into the air and they fly on skis. In the summer, it's just awful. And this year, it's full of scandal. It's always full of scandal anyway, the International Olympic Committee. But this year, they had to fire the director of opening ceremonies just a day before it started because they discovered he'd made a Holocaust joke some years ago.
What an unfortunate set of circumstances for Japan. All the contradictions in their society are being exposed to the world.
I think many women in Japan would say that Japan is biased, and younger people in Japan are the ones who've been calling out the older male hierarchy in Japan who've been making these decisions. So we've been seeing this power struggle going on within Japan, which is not what the Japanese people who were putting on the Olympics wanted to see. They wanted to show the politeness, the traditions of hospitality, and the extremely low crime rate of Japan, all of which is true. And instead, we've been seeing these fissures. And of course, these fissures exist in all societies. So it's, and without the audience and without all these other things to focus on, I think these things have been highlighted.
Have you been following that crazy story about the Norwegian women's handball team, or beach handball, if there's such a thing, and their uniforms?
I actually have followed this team. Yes, Norway's women's beach handball team. They were fined by the European Handball Federation because they wore shorts. They're supposed to wear bikini bottoms. Now, why are they supposed to wear bikini bottoms, you might ask? I guess because it's a beach. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought it would make you play any better, but they're supposed to wear bikini bottoms, quote, with a close fit and cut on an upward angle toward the top of the leg. You've got to think that it's because they want to increase audience. And some of it is. It is because they wanted to increase audience when you actually see the documentation, because it was. They found documents that it was. But the women who play these sports are sick of it.
That's Victoria Jones, the executive director of the DC radio company, discussing the Olympics. And that concludes this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at the past week of Monday, July 19th through Friday, July 23rd, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times.
I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.